Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
You know, there's no, like, heroes. I was a 12-year-old kid showing up at someone's event and making a video of it that, you know, I often heard from customers. They're like, this is better than, like, you know, we had another event a few years ago and I hired the adults, right? You know, like, and this was better, right? And what it kind of made me realize at this very young age is that, you know, we're all just people.
Right.
Right. So you look, when you're a kid, you can think about professionals as people who are like experts, and their whole lives they've done that thing, or they were born a doctor or a lawyer or a, you know, TV producer or whatever it is, right? And you realize, no, we're all just people. We're all just figuring it out on our own.
So how
do I can do anything, like all those other people who I look up to and I'd say like those are professionals, like at one point they were like me, they didn't know anything about anything, and they for the first time had to figure something out.
Among the many business lessons Jeff Lawson has learned, there's this: don't expect to get things done if you wait until you're perfectly prepared. Lawson is co-founder and CEO of Twilio, a company that makes it easy for apps to contact you. Ever wonder how you can send a text to your Uber driver in the app or get one in OpenTable when your seat's ready? Twilio does that. Well, Twilio went public last summer at the New York Stock Exchange and is now worth about $2.5 billion. As it pushes to make apps communicate better, the scrappy San Francisco company has developed a culture that favors boldness and taking initiative and frowns on perfectionism. This is Fort Knox, Rich Ideas and Powerful People. I'm John Fort from CNBC. This is a weekly podcast bringing you the highest achievers from business, entertainment, philanthropy, and sport. We're going to learn how the very best climb to the top and pull out lessons along the way. If that sounds good to you, make this a habit. Subscribe on Apple's podcast app or Google Play or others. And once you've done that, tell a friend. These talks are definitely conversation starters. I caught up with Twilio's CEO at a tech conference in Barcelona, Spain, to talk about his journey from a curious kid in the Detroit suburbs to CEO of a public tech company. Among the things I love about Lawson's story, it's about the setbacks as much as the successes and about learning as you go. Here's Jeff Lawson talking about Twilio and the journey.
Now, you aren't San Francisco born and bred. You're from Michigan.
Yeah.
Suburbs of Detroit.
That's right.
Tell me about that. What was that like growing up?
You know, neat environment to grow up. Obviously, it was suburban, so a rather different environment than, a city like San Francisco. But, you know, one of the things that was great about my growing up is that my parents always encouraged building. You know, I did have a computer. I had my Apple II that I think I did some coding on when I was a kid. But, you know, even just building in that physical sense. Like, I remember when I was a kid, I would build things with my dad. We'd say, like, oh, Dad, I want to build a VCR.
Build a VCR,
right? Okay, and we get a cardboard box.
Oh, right,
and
we draw the buttons
on it.
I did an iPad with my kids a couple of weeks ago.
Right? And then here's the thing. At the end, we'd like, you know, you can't see, I'm making the air quotes, making a VCR. And at the very end, I'd always say, okay, great, Dad, now can we make it really work? And my dad would kind of say, I don't know how to do that part, right? And that's what's so cool about software today, is that with the power of software, and this is for kids and adults and everyone in between, right, you can change the world with a text in, right? Whenever you build software, it does really work. And you can build a mobile app, and even if you're young, right, you can build some website, you can build a mobile app, you can put it online, and if it gets traction, like, you can have millions of users using an app that you built, because that's the power of software, is it can really work.
And
this is amazing. I met a Twilio customer just last week in New York, 17 years old, and they're in the top, I think they were number 6 in the App Store for the social category. Imagine that.
Yeah, that's huge. Where did your entrepreneurial spark come from? Because you started your first business in middle school, right?
I did.
What was the business?
So I've always loved technical things, and one of the things that fascinated me was like video production, and I wanted the gear. I wanted a cool camera, or I wanted to get this gear and learn how to make stuff. But I realized that the only way to get this cool gear when you're 12, 13 years old is to earn the money to do it. So I started a company of videotaping special events like weddings, bar mitzvahs, sweet 16s.
Were you actually doing the taping as a middle schooler?
I was. I would come, my dad would drive me. I didn't have a driver's license yet. My dad would drive me and I would do the videotape. I'd go home and I'd edit it later and deliver them the final product. And that was the first company that I ever started when I was in middle school. It was called Video Visions.
What did you learn from that? Did it go well?
Yeah, I mean, I made money all through middle school, even high school. I stopped.
Got yourself a real VCR?
I did eventually. I didn't make it though. I just learned the value, I think, of hard work. But I also realized the value of, there's no, like, here I was. I was a 12-year-old kid showing up at someone's event and making a video of it that, I often heard from customers. They're like, this is better than, like, we had another event a few years ago and I hired the adults, right? And this was better, right? And what it kind of made me realize at this very young age is that, we're all just people.
Right.
Right. So you look, when you're a kid, you can think about professionals as people who are like experts and their whole lives they've done that thing, or they were born a doctor or a lawyer or a, TV producer or whatever it is, right? And you realize, no, we're all just people. Hmm. We're all just figuring it out on our own.
So how do you learn?
I can do anything. Like all those other people who I look up to and I'd say like those are professionals, at one point they were like me, they didn't know anything about anything, and they for the first time had to figure something out. And I've just always taken that approach. My grandfather was an amazing guy. He, during the Depression, was working in a factory and he wanted to make more money. He had just gotten married, he wanted to make more money.
Do you know what he was making in the factory?
He was doing stocking and stuff like that. Right. And he wanted to make more money. So he went to the owner and he said, I need to make more money. How do I do that? And the guy said, I don't have any other jobs. The only job I have is driving the truck. He said, do you know how to drive the truck? And my grandfather's answer was, give me the keys. And he got this job and he made more money. Now here's the thing that he didn't tell the boss. He had never driven before in his life. Now I love the fact, first of all, he didn't lie.
Right, he said, give me the keys.
He said, give me the keys, right? Which is such a great value. Give me the keys. It's sort of like almost like a lesson that I've internalized. I've actually brought it into totally one of my company and told people like that story and that give me the keys mentality. I'm just saying, you know what? Like, we're here to figure it out. And if we don't figure it out, someone else will. And that's our job. That's what innovators do. And that's what people who want to figure it out. There's no one is going to teach us exactly the things we need to know to be successful.
You use that how to draw an owl?
Yeah, it's similar to the draw an owl, right? it's this meme that we've really internalized. It's one of our core values of the company, draw the owl. It goes back to this old internet meme. It's been around for years.
Yeah.
It's step one, how to draw an owl. Step one, draw some circles. And it's got the loosely sketched, body circle and the head circle. And then it says step two, draw the rest of the owl.
Yeah.
And it's got a beautifully drawn owl. And the joke is, it's funny, but the joke is, of course, you have to figure out everything that happens in the middle. But that's a parallel for business and for life, right? Which is that no one is going to just teach you exactly. Like, life is not a paint-by-number ordeal.
Right.
We have to figure it out.
So how did you, as a middle schooler, maybe even before, learn how to produce professional-level stuff? And how does that method influence how you went on to do everything else?
Yeah, I mean, well, obviously I had a good start. I had a lot of privilege in my growing up that I had a family that could afford to get like my first things. As like my 13 years old, I got a gift was my first camera, and that was enough to get started. And my dad had done a little bit of like video editing and stuff. I think that's how I got the bug. So he taught me the basics of it. But then I took it from there and just kept learning and kept doing it more. And just by repetition, right, you get better and better. And so I started. I'm sure those first ones weren't great. And I don't think I charged very much to those first clients. Maybe it was even free. But that's how I got started. I remember my first job building software was...
How old were you?
It was a freshman year in college.
Okay.
So, I was, how old are you in college? 19. And a friend of mine's dad had a small software company in Detroit. they made software for these big industrial printers. And the web had just come around. This is 1996. And they needed a web interface for it. And so my friend hooked me up, and I talked to him about building this web interface for their big industrial printing software thing. And the guy says, oh, yeah, you're like, so what do you know about web development? I'm like, well, you know, what do you need? And he says, well, I need it built in Delphi. And I wrote down my number, okay, Delphi. And then he says, I need it to be a SQL backend. And I'm writing down SQL. And I had no idea what these things were. I was just writing them down. I said, oh, yeah, it should be fine. You know, let me get back to you in a week with an estimate. I went out, and I looked up all those things, figured out what it would take, and built it. And again, it's that draw the owl or give me the keys mentality, which yeah. is the best way to learn something new is to commit yourself to doing it.
Yeah. Now, you also took what a lot of people would see as a big risk and took 4 years off of college to follow your entrepreneurial dreams. What was it that convinced you to do that, and why did you go back? Because a lot of tech founders, it's like, oh, I left college at whatever point, and then they don't go back.
Yeah, you know, I started my first, let's say, venture-funded company, or my first, you know, kind of bigger company, when I was an undergraduate in school. It was a lecture note company for college students, and you know, first we had started it as a side project, mostly because I just wanted to play around with this brand new thing called the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating new technology, and again, what better way to force yourself to figure it out than to say, let's start a company and like build a product. And so we built this product, Lecture Notes for College Students, and in the course of building that, we kind of got a lot of traction. We started at the University of Michigan, which is where I was in school, and we expanded it out to a few more campuses, and then an advisor said, you know, this is a really neat idea, but this is like 1998 at this point.
Right.
And he said, you know, this internet thing is hot, like, you know, companies are getting started, this internet's brand new, it's taken off. Like, are you, you know, this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to build a company with this idea that you have. The University of Michigan's going to be around forever, roughly, but, you know, the opportunity to build an internet company, now is the time. And so he said, you know what, let's do that. So we ended up raising some money, raising angel money, and then a venture round.
How did you do that as a college student? Because there wasn't as much of a roadmap back then. That's when people were kind of doing that in the dot-com era for the first time. How did you figure out how to do it?
And from Michigan, right?
Right.
Yeah, you know, we raised a round from friends and family with this idea of saying, hey, we'll build this service for college students. And, you know, we believe that we'll have a great advertising play, which was the revenue model.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at that point in time, a lot of people wanted to invest. I mean, the internet was brand new. It was a tremendous amount of excitement. Obviously, there was a little too much excitement in retrospect. But, you know, we actually didn't have that much trouble just going to people who essentially wanted to be a part of this brand new thing called the internet. And then that was our angel round, and then our venture round. We made trips out to Silicon Valley, and we had traction at that point.
And what year is that?
99.
Okay, you're running out of time.
Yeah, nobody knew it. Yeah, no, we raised a bunch of money, about I think $10 million, and moved the whole company from Michigan to Silicon Valley.
Right.
And
I hope you sold it within.
We actually did. We sold it to a competitor of ours for stock, though.
Okay. And, I was right there with you.
But it was a wild .com. I mean, we literally went from the dorm room to like raising money at a $25 million valuation to selling it for $100 million to the company that acquired us being bankrupt a few months later.
Yeah.
But that whole thing in like, you know, 24 months roughly. It was an insane ride. But it was what a rocket boosters on an entrepreneurial career that we were able to learn so much in that short period of time as such young people that I then took a lot of those lessons forward.
And you went back to Michigan.
I did. I did a few things first, but at one point I realized that my credits that I had already paid for at the university were going to disappear. They were going to expire. And I said, you know what? It's free education. And it was a good time in my career. Like, it's a good time to take a break. And I was like, you know, I'm not going to turn down free education.
Tell me about maybe bouncing back. I imagine the end of that ride, if you're, you know, in your early 20s, feeling like I've got this company worth 25, 100 million to the acquirer goes bankrupt. That must be hard, especially if you raised money from friends and family who were also counting on this whole thing to happen.
Well, you know, I always told them don't count on, you know, angel investments for anything.
But, you know.
You know, for me, well, first of all, it was an amazing experience to be able to at such a young age, get to be a part of that whole that process, not only of company building, and I've been an entrepreneur, but not really anything at that kind of scale, to be able to build a company, do the fundraising. I'd never done fundraising before. Hire a bunch of people, you know, things I'd done entrepreneurially before that had been just me not hiring a bunch of people. So yeah, we had to figure out a whole lot of stuff, but it was a great ride. And then, you know, you think you know how life is going to play out. Like, here I am, everyone's saying, oh, you know, you're the dorm room genius who's got the thing. And you're like, you start to believe it, and then suddenly it's not true. And you think you know how life is going to play out because, you know, it just seems like such a kind of a, the storybook entrepreneurial tale of Silicon Valley. And then it all falls apart and you realize, you know, this is just life. You never know what it's going to give you. And you have to, you know, hope for the best, expect the worst, and roll with what happens.
When did that perspective come? And how did you get it? I imagine it didn't come immediately.
You know, there wasn't some process of grieving, I would say. It all was very natural. So it became, since some, they sort of unfold over time so you can acclimate yourself to what's happening. But ultimately, you know, you just roll on your next thing.
Plus, it was almost like a natural disaster, right? It wasn't like it was just you affected.
Yeah, right.
I mean, the dot-com meltdown was like a major global story.
And, you know, and in retrospect, as you're looking at it, you're like, yeah, kind of makes sense, right? The company that acquired us was spending way too much money for where they were, and, you know, they ran into the wall. But you know what? Right around that time, you know, one door opens, one door closes, another opens, right? Classically, right? That was right when two friends of mine were starting StubHub. They said, hey, we have this idea for a new business, and to enable a secondhand marketplace for live event tickets. And they both were bankers, and they had never operated a company before. They said, would you like to, you know, you just built this startup, you just built a technology team, you scaled it up, like, we want to come do that again for us. And I said, sure. And so it's sort of a natural way to say, like, yep, I just learned a lot. Let me go apply what I learned to something new. And that's kind of the way I've always looked at it. I mean, the best thing that we have as we go through our careers is our knowledge and our work, our reputation, right? And if you are constantly building those two things, I think generally speaking, you know, good things end up happening to people.
And what did you get out of the StubHub experience?
Biggest thing I learned, you know, neat experience, great business, doing incredibly well. But I realized that it wasn't the product for me to be putting my blood, sweat, and tears into.
Why?
So as an entrepreneur, I mean, you just put so much into building a business. And I wasn't the customer for that product. I wasn't a concert goer.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't go to a lot of concerts.
You weren't passionate about
it. It was just like, it was like e-commerce of another thing.
Right.
And it was a fine business, but I wasn't the customer, and I didn't feel passionately that the world needed the product we were building. I didn't think it was bad. I just wasn't passionate about it. It wasn't viscerally great. And as an entrepreneur, I think you need that. I think you need to feel passionate and have this visceral feeling about the world needs. And it's not to say everything that every entrepreneur builds is like world-changing or, you know, saving the earth. But you do need to feel like the customers you're serving, you've made a small part of their life better because of the thing that you're building. And that's what gets you through the long nights and the, you know, sleeplessness and all the stress and things like that, right? Is that belief that ultimately for your customers the world will be better if you succeed in building what you want to build. And so I realized I didn't really have that kind of passion for StubHub, which ultimately is what made me decide to move on and work on other things. And that's been, I think, one of the most valuable lessons I've learned along the way, is that you have to be passionate. And you have to have that visceral, feel that visceral need for the product you're building in order to really do your best work.
So what'd you do next?
After that, I went and started, of all things, a bricks and mortar retailer for extreme sporting goods. And I am not a participant in extreme sports. I'm not a skateboarder. I'm not a surfer. I'm not a snowboarder. And so, despite what I just said to you about being passionate, would you believe it? I made the same mistake again.
Okay.
And it took me a couple of years, and I realized that I made that same.
Now, what got you to make that mistake? What convinced you? I'm not into extreme sports, but I'm going to do it.
We had researched a lot of different interesting ideas for technology companies we could start, but strangely enough, the one that myself and my co-founders all agreed on was a good business opportunity, was creating a category killer retailer for extreme sporting goods, sort of being like an REI is for hiking, climbing, and camping, while doing it for the next game sports of skateboarding, snowboarding, surfing. You know, we always said REI is for granola eating, ours are Pop-Tart eating sports. And So it just seemed like a good business opportunity. It was a $30 billion market. Sorry, it was a $16 billion market growing at 30% year over year in the early 2000s. I mean, it was just sort of like this big thing. And there was no retailer with any significant presence. And so it just sounds like one of these like business school looking, I've never been to business school, I assume that's what they do there. You know, one of these business school looking, like, you know, classic good business opportunities. And I was a little hesitant, but then I thought about it and I was like, you know what, this is an opportunity to build some very interesting technology. You know, how many retailers start up with no legacy, no baggage in, you know, 2000s and get to use technology to make them run great, make great customer experiences, be operationally tight. And so I thought that was an interesting challenge that I wanted to undertake as a technologist.
Right.
And so we ended up building, we built a point of sale system, we built back of house shipping and receiving, we built all the systems around the store to really build something that was better than all the off-the-shelf software that was out there. But at the end of the day, it was still about selling skateboards. And when I push comes to shove, I was like, I'm not asking about this product. And that's when I went to Amazon, where I was one of the first product managers at Amazon Web Services.
Yeah. What convinced you to go to Amazon? What did you get out of that experience that helped you to become a better entrepreneur?
Yeah, I'd done an entrepreneurial thing multiple times in a row. I wanted to see what it's like at a bigger company. Because I knew as an entrepreneur, if I'm successful, I'm going to want to build a larger company one day. And I mean, that's kind of what success means for an entrepreneur, right?
Right.
But I have no idea what happens at bigger companies. I've never worked at one. I know there's these big tall buildings and the logo at the top. People walk in at 9 and they walk out at 5 and I have no idea what they do in the middle. Right? Because I've only been a part of like relatively small startups where it's just, you know, everyone does what like is absolutely on fire that day. And that's about it, right? And I realized that part of my entrepreneurial toolkit should be learning from a great company. So I had a short list of companies that I thought that, you know, met my criteria of what a great company was, and ended up going up to Seattle to go to Amazon. And interestingly enough, speaking to the passion thing, it was my first opportunity to build products for developers. Hmm. Which again, I was a developer. This is my, you know, I love writing code. And so it was right in my wheelhouse of things I thought were really serving a customer that I knew and understood, you know, myself as a developer, but also that this new form of platform and infrastructure and service would be really valuable to helping developers to move even faster and build even better software. That's why it was so exciting to be there.
How did you know when it was time to leave and start Twilio?
I had the entrepreneurial itch. I enjoyed my time at Amazon, bigger company, learned a lot, but I just felt that it was my time to return to my entrepreneurial roots and to start something new.
How did that end up being the thing?
How did
Twilio end up being
Twilio,
the thing?
Twilio, yeah. Well, I looked around at a lot of different ideas of what I wanted to do next. And one of the things that I realized was that all three of my previous companies, I had two things in common. First was that every one of those companies, we were using the power of software to beat our competition. The power of software being your ability to iterate fast, mm-hmm. ship something quickly, learn from your customers, better understand their needs, update, you know, build the next iteration, and do that roughly every 2 weeks. So that's the nature of agile software. And that you could continually iterating your way towards the perfect solution. And that's the superpower of software, that okay. iterative spirit. But the second common thread of all those three companies was at one point or another, we needed great communications in order to have that great customer experience.
Great communications. Tell me.
Some way in which our software, our company, needed to interact with our end users.
Okay.
And every time we had ideas about how to build a great customer experience that involved communications, we'd say, okay, well, that's neat, but we don't know anything about communications. Right? We're software developers. Making a phone ring is magical as far as I'm concerned, right? And so we turn to the communications industry and we say, okay, how are we supposed to build this idea that we have? And the communications industry would always say a similar thing. They'd say, oh, yeah, we can help you with that. You know, first you're going to run up one of these copper wires from the carrier to your data center. And then step two, you're going to rack up a bunch of telco gear in that data center. And then you're going to bring in a bunch of professional services people because that gear was never designed to do this idea that you had. You're going to bring in this small army of professional services to come and bang it into submission and get it to do what you want to do. We think we can make it work. It'll cost about $2 million and it'll take 24 months to implement. And at every one of those companies, I remember having the same reaction. First of all, $2 million for this like part of my customer experience. I'm like, I don't have the money to spend on that. But even if I did, let's say I was some big enterprise and I had the money to spend on that.
Uh-huh.
The most offensive part of this was the time. 2 years before a customer would ever get their hands on the thing, this idea. 2 years before I'd know if the idea was any good.
Right.
Right? And then no ability to iterate on it thereafter. It's all the professional services people back up and go home. Right? And so this whole idea that you'd spend 2 years to deploy version one and have no idea if customers were getting value out of it was insane to a software person like myself, who's used to shipping every 2 weeks. And I came to realize that the communications industry is diametrically opposed to that ethos of software. I mean, if you think about it, right, they probably should be, right? Because for 100 years, they've been digging trenches in the ground and launching satellites and building towers and all this stuff, right? High-risk, high-reward activities that you're going to do very slowly and very planfully. And that's all well and good, but software that sits on top of that infrastructure is moving at a very different pace.
Yeah.
And the industry had not caught up to that. And so we started Twilio in 2008 to solve that problem of bringing communications out of that legacy in hardware and physical networks and into a future which is based in software and empower the software developers of the world to really build the future of communications, which is certainly going to be in software.
Interesting. So you strike me as a storyteller. I don't know if that comes from your film and an artistic
sit down
background.
And I shall tell you a tale. Yeah, I mean, I do. I was a film major in addition to computer science, and I do enjoy that part of the world.
How does that play out in the company's culture? It seems through kind of these 9 core values that they tell a sort of story about what Twilio is. Are you trying to communicate right in the door to employees what the expectations are? How does that all come together?
Absolutely. You know, the values of the company are there really to tell everybody how, you know, how we're going to behave, how we're going to work together. How is this going to work? Who should be here and who shouldn't be here, right? This is how you share those values. And, you know, the storytelling...
Are there controversial values among those 9 that some people go, whoa, what's that about?
I think people ask questions, but I think ultimately they, if they are attracted to Twilio, it's because they buy into the things that we believe in. Things like that draw the owl notion.
Right.
Right, which is...
Is that the one you get the most questions about?
It's the most not obvious, right? But we do get questions about that. I think an interesting one, going to your storytelling comment, one of our values is start with why. And there's a great book by that name as well, which I think was influential in creating of this value. But to us, it's about why is the driver behind the decisions we make. And so if you only tell people, like, here's the decisions, right? And here's the thing, right? You're not going to get a lot of buy-in, you're not going to have understanding. And certainly people can't run, you know, what do you call it, the commander's intent, right? But why is so critical. Explaining why we're making the decisions we are. Or why, what motivates us? What's the customer problem we're trying to solve? Not what's the solution. Sharing why inside the company is so powerful. Because that's how you actually express, you know, if you will, the commander's intent. Mm-hmm. And you free people up to run and use their ideas to figure out how best to answer the problem we're trying to solve, because they understand why we're doing it the way we're doing it. Or to take things in a direction you may have never imagined as a leader, because the company understands why we're doing the things we're doing, not just what we're doing today. And so I've always really liked that start with why. And it does often come to this kind of storytelling place of saying, here's the reason why things are the way they are, or here's why we're solving the problem we are, or here's why we do things the way we do them, is because that tells the story of a non-rigid world.
Yeah.
That you want people to internalize what motivates us, what motivates our customers, in order to make the best decisions they can.
This year, Uber has been in the headlines quite a bit over its cultural challenges. When you're working on your company's culture, how do you make sure that if something is going on in the organization that you don't agree with, if somebody's getting harassed, if the culture is getting too aggressive, if it's getting too mean, that you know about it and can influence it before it gets ingrained?
Yeah, well, let's separate the difference between, like, aggressive. You know, you want your company to think aggressively, you think boldly about what it wants to accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
But you can separate that from how people work together. And when you cross that line and you need to define it very clearly, and that's what, you know, you've got employment policy and behavioral policy, things like that. Code of conduct, that's what I'm looking for. You take a zero tolerance policy. Nobody gets a buy because they're the high performer, because they're a vice president of this or that, right? Nobody gets a buy on things that matter to your code of conduct or your tolerance or how you treat each other. Because that is, that sends a powerful signal. If it's tolerated by some, then it'll probably be tolerated by all. And that you just can't have that. And I think that's one of the important things you do. A, draw the boundaries around this is the okay behavior, right? This is our values. And this is the not okay behavior. You know, not only is it outside of our values, it's outside of our code of conduct. And you put that in black and white and make sure people understand that. And then you enforce it. And that's the biggest thing. I mean, probably most companies today have a policy that says, you know, you can't discriminate, you can't, you know, sexual harassment is not, I mean, this is, it's not just company policy, it's the law.
Right.
But every company, I'm sure, has that, but how many of them turn a blind eye? That's the problem. And what you need to do is have that zero tolerance policy. Because that's the difference between, and I feel like it is almost binary. You never have a company where it's zero tolerance, but if you don't have that, then you'll probably have those bad behaviors.
What's your best piece of advice to the entrepreneurial middle schooler who's maybe looking to follow that path? That'll be my last question.
Give me the keys, right? Just think about that, right? People who do some job, who you look up to, right? They at some point, prior to where they are today, were just like you. They didn't know everything. They couldn't do the things they can do today. They weren't confident. They had their own demons, whatever it is. Everybody does. That's just human experience. So you out there, you've got everything it takes, just like people who you may look up to. You think, oh, I'll never be like that. I'll never be a doctor or a lawyer or an entrepreneur or the CEO of a company or whatever it is. It's like, nope, everyone has gotten to where they are, had a path to get there. So do you. So just do it. Give me the keys.
All right. Give me the keys. Draw the owl. Jeff, thanks.
Thank you very much, man.
My thanks to Jeff Lawson. I'm John Fort from CNBC, and this has been Fort Knox, Rich Ideas and Powerful People. Subscribe on Apple's podcast app, Google Play, or wherever fine podcasts are distributed. And please do leave a review if you enjoyed this. And check out Fort Knox Live on Facebook, Twitter, and Periscope, usually Wednesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern. There I tackle some of the most interesting business and economic issues with a little help from my friends at CNBC and from you. Next on the podcast, a little something different. Ajit Pai is the new chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, an agency charged with regulating America's communication industries. In the digital era, lots of old limitations are evaporating and new dangers are materializing. That's made his job very controversial. Go ahead and subscribe to Fort Knox now on your iPhone's podcast app or on Google Play. You don't want to miss that. Meanwhile, share this. Tell a friend. Drop me a note on Facebook, Twitter, or fortknox.com. That's FORTTKNOX.com. And as always, thank you for lending an ear.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.